Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and it's been, I think, a very interesting meeting. I'm going to be very brief to leave ample time for discussion. There should be a lot of it. And I also feel I must be brief because the topic is, you know, where do we go from here? And historians are really not very good at that. I mean, they specialize in where we've been and how we've gotten to where we are. And I might say that if I had any illusions about how wise historians are about public policy choices, they were dashed close to 50 years ago when I had my first graduate seminar at Harvard from Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who does indeed know a lot of history and has done some valuable historical work a very long time ago, but whose wisdom is certainly in question. So what I thought I would do would be to make a few very brief comments on some of the historical issues that have cropped up today, or in some cases, not cropped up. But first, I did think it was worth making a couple of comments about Carol Swain's very interesting suggestions about kind of current policy issues. And as to the first, the apology, I do have great reservations about that on at least a couple of grounds. First, I think some kind of national apology will not be the end of it, but only an opening of the door. Oh, okay, now you've pleaded guilty, so what are we going to get? We don't want just an apology. That is, I think it would lend force to the reparations movement rather than, you know, stifle it or put an end to it. And I do have to say that it seems to me a profoundly unhealthy preoccupation with history. We all are products of our history and should be aware of it. But to think that, you know, several generations removed from slavery, we should be telling young people, you will not be whole in America. You will be significantly limited by this heritage of something that affected your great, great, great grandparents, perhaps. And until something is done, an apology at a minimum, but preferably, you know, big bucks, you know, you probably needn't work too hard in school. You shouldn't draw great, you know, plans for the future. I think it is absolutely poisonous. Now, you know, I certainly respect Carol's view, and I'm sure she could explain it to me in ways that would make me feel, you know, a little less emphatic, but that's my take on it. Then on immigration, that is a fascinating issue, an important issue, and one that so bewilderingly cuts across ideological lines. I mean, if you think about who seems to essentially think just about unrestricted immigration would be fine. Let the illegals come, give them driver's licenses, let them vote even. Well, who thinks that? Well, I mean, like, there are a bunch of left-wingers on the New York City Council and there are other city councils who take that view. And then it seems to me that, well, that's pretty much the view of the Wall Street Journal. Yeah, we want an absolutely free-flowing labor market, though the Wall Street Journal would certainly not want voting rights necessarily extended in that way. I do think it's a complicated issue and that there are some definite trade-offs that a certain high level of extremely unskilled immigration is harmful to native low-skilled workers, disproportionate numbers of whom are black. So that is a serious concern. On the other hand, there are some powerful arguments that immigrants don't just take jobs, they create jobs, and immigrant entrepreneurship is an obvious fact of many of our cities, some of which large areas were in, suffering from advanced urban blight until a new wave of immigrants from Jamaica or Pakistan or wherever entered in, and these people are not only self-supporting but are contributing to a broader urban economy in which members of other groups can share. So I do think it's complicated, and it is interesting that it is playing no role at all in the presidential campaign. Indeed, now I think of it, before the previous election, I was asked to be a member of a task force to formulate immigration policy for the Bush campaign. And I exchanged a few emails on that, and then somehow the whole thing became dormant and then was dissolved because they decided, well, there wasn't an immigration issue, at least that they wanted to address. Okay, just a few other observations about, the history that has been reported on and analyzed in these last 2 days. I think it is interesting that there is a broad consensus that the story of black people in the 20th century is fundamentally a story of kind of onward and upward from the absolute nadir in African American history at the beginning of the 20th century, when blacks have been totally driven from the polls and from political office with widespread terror and violence, when segregation codes are created and enforced, designed to keep them separate and subordinate, not separate but equal. And then the progress that was made up to the 1960s, where there seems to be consensus among the speakers that things began to go awry. Now, there has been a little controversy today over Brown, and if I could just say a mediating word, I hope I don't sound too Clintonian if I say the issue between Abby and Midge depends upon the meaning of lead to. That is, Midge is concerned that Brown led to a bunch of things that she thinks were unwise and unfortunate in New York City, for example. And Abby, in responding to that, is saying, well, it did in a way lead to those things. They followed after and referred to Brown. But if you look at Brown itself, it is far more open-ended, and that there is nothing in Brown that inexorably led us down the road to turmoil in the New York City school systems over racial imbalance, all the way to mass busing in Boston and other places, that a whole series of other things intervened to change the original meaning of Brown. And indeed, I think it is worth just one more point on Brown, worth noting, that it clearly envisaged a continuation of neighborhood-based pupil assignment systems. That is, there is a footnote which directs the parties for Brown 2, when they entered the remedy phase, the second decision to be handed down a year later, to propose remedies, desegregation remedies, consistent with traditional pupil assignment by geography. And since the court did know there were large parts of America where mainly black people lived or mainly white people lived, it's perfectly clear that they thought at the time that schools that were all black or overwhelmingly black would be consistent with the enforcement of Brown, or they couldn't have put that footnote in. Okay, well, enough on that. Then there is consensus that we took the wrong turn somewhere in the 60s. I did want to comment on Bill Allen's hypothesis that no, actually, we first took the wrong turn in 1949 with the James Baldwin critique of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I think I don't want to get into the details of that, but I would say just very quickly that I think Bill defends Stowe quite interestingly, but that James Baldwin's real target in that essay was Richard Wright and Richard Wright's native son specifically, and that that is a very valuable essay and critique offered by James Baldwin, because in fact, native son, if you're thinking of the history of white racial guilt, which Shelby talked about so well last night, Native Son is kind of the text. I mean, that is the most powerful expression in all of American literature of the most important development of a case designed to make whites feel profoundly guilty about their racial crimes. And from that point of view, it's a very powerful and very valuable book. At the same time, it's a very important book, as Baldwin pointed out, for its dehumanization of black people, its treatment. It's the locus classicus of the black as victim. Bigger Thomas and the other black characters, it too, are purely products of white racism. They have no autonomy. They have no humanity. And indeed, there is this weird presentation that Bigger Thomas becomes human only by committing murder. So there are some very interesting issues there. And I do think that the Baldwin comment that white liberals get such a thrill of virtue from reading Native Son, and one said to him, so long as books like this are being written, all will be well. I think that fits into Shelby's account very well and very interestingly. And I was going to go into Ralph Ellison here as well, Lucas Morell spoke of so well this morning. He got into a very interesting controversy with Irving Howe over Richard Wright and Native Son, and in particular, and Irving Howe defended that book saying that no black man, no black writer could write anything but a protest novel. Of course you write a kind of propagandistic political tract. What else can you do given the total degradation in which this oppressive society forces you to live? And Ralph Ellison wrote a wonderful rejoinder to that, you know, in effect saying, well, you know, thanks, white boy, for the instruction on how I must feel and what I'm capable of writing, but I don't think you quite have it right. Well, things did go wrong in the 60s and wrong after, as Bill McClay so wonderfully described at today's luncheon, after we saw this glorious triumph of essentially a religious movement, though that's a dimension, I have to say, one of Bill's former teachers, Ken Lynn, wrote a wonderful review of American Black and White, in which he praised many aspects of it, but he said, unfortunately, the Thernstroms are tone deaf to religion. And I do plead guilty to that, and I think this analysis of the civil rights movement that Bill offered is extremely interesting and persuasive to me. So then the question comes, though, how do we go from that complex, nuanced religious movement to the era of racial preferences dictated by authorities in Washington? And I think Shelby's argument is, as far as it goes, is extremely suggestive and compelling. There are some questions about it. How deeply does this sense of white guilt really penetrate? I mean, yes, John Lindsay felt it. Yes, Lyndon Johnson felt it. Yes, many faculty members today still feel it. Indeed, just as a case in point, supporting this view, white guilt and the connection to racial preferences, after the passage of 209, some of you may not know, but the Stanford Faculty Senate had a meeting to discuss this terribly distressing development, and they passed a resolution reaffirming Stanford's commitment to racial preferences unanimously. And, you know, think about that. I mean, the Stanford faculty cannot come close to unanimity on whether, you know, should there be a foreign language requirement? Should there be any great books taught at Stanford? I would bet if you knew the history that the Stanford faculty was not 100% on the interventionist rather than the isolationist side in 1940. I would imagine there were even critics of the Marshall Plan or every other thing you can think of. There is, you know, real division, obviously, but they've achieved unanimity on this, which does suggest it has a religious significance for them. Now, of course, they didn't really achieve unanimity, one imagines. There must have been some cowards who thought, this is a bad idea, but I'm not going to stick my neck out. But I was, just a final comment, I was, you know, thinking about this issue of how deeply this white guilt penetrated. And it's easy to think, well, sure, I mean, you know, the college faculties and Ivy League students and the New York Times and so on, but what about, you know, the man on the street? And I do offer some data that does, I think, get to the level of the man and woman on the street. And much of the survey data about racial attitudes, of course, has to be approached with some suspicion. I mean, are people really telling pollsters what they think and feel, or what they perceive is expected of a decent person? But this happens to be data gathered not with by anyone researching racial attitudes. It was some commercial filmmakers who were trying to figure out public attitudes about, you know, what really puts off people when they see it in a movie? What do we really have to watch out for? So I don't think the respondents, some big national sample, are thinking in racial terms at the outset of this. But it turned out that the second most offensive thing that you could possibly put into a movie, the thing that almost was first in terms of saying, I don't want to see it, that's horrible, were negative racial stereotypes. That came in at 85%. It was beaten by one other thing. 87% felt really offended at the prospect of scenes depicting homosexual sexual activity. Now, it seems to me that is a very telling commentary of how far American racial attitudes have been transformed, and you might say that's not guilt, but something else, but it seems to me at least very pertinent to the story that Shelby was telling. Well, I had other points I wanted to touch on, but we're already at 5:30, and I will leave it at that.